I'm Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. I want to welcome you on behalf of our board and Senator Rockefeller, our honorary chairman, to this program designed to help the members of the press cover the arguments scheduled to begin a week from Monday, March 26th, in the Supreme Court on the constitutionality of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. It is okay in the confines of this room to call it the ACA. We will not make that an ideological test. Very few cases before the court in recent years have attracted as much attention as the ones to be argued about the ACA. We even have polls most recently from the Kaiser Family Foundation on the general public's opinion of the constitutionality of this law. By the way, they think it's not constitutional, so maybe the court doesn't have to rule. There's a lot of good information in your packets about that, including the poll. And I can't tell you how many calls we have gotten about this program, in large part because of the illustrious nature of our panelists and also because of the momentous nature of the case. More than 100 friend of the court briefs filed in the case. Good luck getting a seat at the arguments in the press section. Stuart Taylor said in a piece today that the 6 hours of arguments that are scheduled over those 3 days are the most time that the court has given to any case since 1966. So this is a big deal, and it's no wonder. We are talking not only about a law that affects 1/6 of the entire economy, but one that has enough of a political impact that one analysis that I saw last week says it cost the Democrats control of the House all by itself, 6 or 7 percentage points in the popular vote, 25 seats, enough to have the Republicans able to take over the House back in the 2010. So a lot of folks are awaiting the words you'll be writing and airing over the next weeks and months about this case. Now, today you're going to be hearing from astute constitutional lawyers who have very different views of what the court should do and presumably what it will do when its decision is announced, presumably sometime in June, and you'll hear one of the most distinguished observers of the court about what to expect in the arguments. We're very pleased to have as a partner in today's program the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the country's largest philanthropy devoted exclusively to promoting health and health care for our country. Let me just do a quick logistical checklist, if I can, before we get to our program. As I mentioned, there's a lot of background information in your kits, including speaker bios that are more extensive than the ones I'm going to be able to give to our panelists today. In a few days, you'll be able to see a transcript of this briefing on our website at allhealth.org. And if you need help with any aspect of your work on this topic or any other, be sure to contact Bill Irwin, who's our Director of Communications, off to my left, and he'll be able to help you or tell you where you can get it. Now, let's get to the program. We have a very knowledgeable group of panelists today with a broad range of experience. They're going to give some brief remarks and open it to your questions. And I'll introduce all of them now so that we won't interrupt the flow of the conversation. We'll start with Simon Lazarus on my immediate left. He's the policy counsel for the National Council of Senior Citizens Law Center. I'm sorry, the National Senior Citizens Law Center here in Washington. He's written on issues surrounding the ACA for a number of publications. He served on the domestic policy staff of the White House under President Carter a few years ago. I guess it was a few years ago. And a few years before that, he was the notes and comment editor of the Yale Law Journal. Next to Cy is Bill McCollum, who's a partner in SNR Denton's public policy and regulation practice here in town. He came to the firm after serving as Attorney General of the state of Florida, and as Attorney General, Mr. McCollum addressed a range of issues. Most relevantly for today's discussion, he filed the suit challenging the constitutionality of the ACA the day that it was signed into law in 2010. He also served a decade in the U.S. House of Representatives from Florida. Next to Bill McCollum is Lyle Denniston, a legal journalist, professor, and author. He's reported on the Supreme Court for half a century. Currently writes for SCOTUS Blog, an online blog featuring news and analysis of the court, and has written in the past for the Wall Street Journal, the Boston Globe, the Baltimore Sun, where he was the last time he was on a panel for the Alliance, the American Lawyer, the Washington Star. If you're lucky enough to get a seat for the Supreme Court arguments on the ACA, you'll see a plaque in his honor in the Supreme Court press room. So we have got quite a panel, and we're going to start with Simon Lazarus. Si?
Thanks very much, Ed. And it's moderately intimidating to be here in front of this distinguished audience and with these distinguished fellow panelists. I'm going to try to make three quick points that I think are the most important points for people covering this historic case to focus on. The first point is that the single most important thing that has happened since these cases were filed by my colleague here and his colleagues 2 years ago is the fact that without exception, eminent conservative judges and Republican appointees have come down strongly in favor of upholding the mandate. That is Judge Lawrence Silberman of the D.C. Circuit, Judge Jeffrey Sutton of the Sixth Circuit, both of whom are among the most respected jurists, conservative or liberal, in the country, and certainly icons among conservative legal, in conservative legal circles. And both of them stayed true to the mainstream judicial conservative commitment, A, to judicial restraint, and more specifically, to an understanding that, as Judge Silberman put it very succinctly and powerfully, Congress must have authority to forge national solutions to national problems. And that is an overall philosophical view that, that mainstream conservatives, as distinguished from the very small cadre of libertarian conservatives, have consistently held, including Robert Bork, Ed Meese in an earlier iteration, Justice Scalia, Justice Kennedy, et cetera. So that, I think, is very important. It underscores the fact that under existing constitutional law, these cases are easy cases, and the both the individual mandate and the Medicaid expansion provisions should readily be upheld. And the fact that these conservative judges stayed true to that view is quite significant. It certainly doesn't guarantee that the Supreme Court, a Supreme Court majority, will do the same, but it certainly underscores the fact that if the members of the conservative bloc, with the exception of Justice Thomas, take a different view, they will be changing their own precedents and making a new departure in terms of what conservative jurisprudence is all about. The second point I'd like to make is that, contrary to what Bill and his eloquent colleagues on that side of the issue have often very effectively maintained, the individual mandate is not some unprecedented invasion of individual liberty. It is merely a version of a principle that is well recognized and well established, and that is, if you have a social insurance program of any kind, you have to have some kind of arrangement for the eventual beneficiaries to contribute to the insurance pool up front before they start drawing on that pool. And if it's Medicare, then they pay Medicare taxes over the course of their whole working lifetime. No one thinks that this is some kind of awful imposition. They actually think it's, rather than a burden, it's a bargain, which it is. And, of course, it's taxes, that sort of taxation is even more mandatory than the individual mandate is. So if you, as Judge Brett Kavanaugh in the D.C. Circuit pointed out very intelligently, and I recommend his opinion to you all, if you want to privatize the social safety net, as conservative policy wonks do and have, then you really have to have a mandate. Like the individual mandate, and he pointed to the ACA as indeed a move toward privatization of the social safety net. So, and replacing taxes with a requirement that people, most people who can afford it, carry insurance. So that is the second point. And the third point, very briefly, is this, and that is the mandate is not the only potential earthquake issue on the Supreme Court's agenda for the end of the month. Almost no attention has been paid, with all due respect, in the media, and I can understand why, but it is a fact, to the Medicaid expansion claim. And the fact is that this is a very significant potential issue. Under existing law, the challenge that Bill and his colleagues have brought will be summarily dismissed, as the courts below did, but maybe their quest to change the law will have a receptive audience among enough members of the Supreme Court to bear some fruit. I don't think that will happen, but it could well happen. And I would just point out that the claim here, no matter how you look at it, would have the effect of undermining and potentially invalidating Medicaid in general, not just the expansion that the ACA provides for, but also all federal aid to education, guarantees against discrimination by recipients of federal funds. I mean, we wouldn't have women's intercollegiate sports if it were not for Title IX, and the theory that the challengers to this Medicaid expansion provision are advancing could well spell serious trouble, if not a doom, for those kinds of strong guarantees. So I just make a pitch to pay some attention to that issue because it could be very important.
Very good. Bill?
Thank you very much, Simon and Lyle. I'm really glad to be here with you, and I want up front to thank the Alliance and the Robert Woods Johnson Foundation for hosting this today and letting us air a little bit preliminarily to the Court's oral arguments about what this case means. Up front, I'd like to say that I doubt anyone in this room, and certainly the panelists here, will disagree on the fundamentals of what we need to do in the broad sense for health care. We do need to have quality, affordability, accessibility of health care in this country. We also know that there are expenses that are involved and that people need to be insured, and some people can't afford to be insured by paying it out of their pocket or may not be employed by an employer who can, and so on. The issue is not whether those things need to be addressed, but it's how you address them. And there's a policy question, and then there's also a balancing of interest question. And the court case is really about the balancing of interest. I mean, the Congress addresses the policy question. We're looking, and the states looked when they filed the lawsuit that our office filed, that I filed back when this was first signed, that first day that Ed mentioned. We looked at the question of the interest involved, and we said to ourselves, first of all, that the 26 states that eventually joined this, 13 of us at the beginning, this is going to wreck our budgets. We can't afford this. The federal government's coming in and coercing and commandeering and doing something bigger than it's ever done before, and it didn't ask our permission. And this isn't some little rider on the Medicaid provision that Simon's referring to, the provision I'm talking about now, the last point we made in the brief and in the lawsuit. But this is something that will destroy our ability to fund education and lots of other things. And as a practical matter, nobody in his right mind in Congress, least of all, believes that states are going to voluntarily withdraw from the Medicaid program. So we got together and we came up with this lawsuit and brought two principal issues. And there are those two principal issues are the challenge to the constitutionality of the individual mandate. That is the provision that says that you either have insurance. If you don't already have coverage, you have to go out and buy a policy, or you have to pay or get coverage somehow, or you have to pay a penalty. And then the provision that says that under the Medicaid changes that are in this law, the states have got to do all the things that are in there. And I'll run through a couple of those in a second, but I wanted to lay that groundwork. The court has taken up a third thing we made as a point, and that is that if you find the individual mandate to be unconstitutional, and that's a condition for the third point, then we think that it is not severable. That is, you can't just carve it out of the bill. It means the whole bill goes down and the whole bill is declared unconstitutional, which is what Judge Vinson did in Pensacola in the district court in this case. The other option, which is there besides saying, you know, you can carve it out, is that other provisions like the insurance provisions, and there are many, many of them in here, will have to fall if the individual mandate is declared unconstitutional, because the basis upon determining severability in the court is what Congress intended. Would the law have been passed? Would they have enacted it if they didn't have a mechanism like the individual mandate to pay for it? And so those are the three great issues in here. The fourth issue the court has taken up, and it's kind of raised it itself a bit, is the question of timeliness, the question of jurisdiction at the beginning, and you'll hear a lot about the Anti-Injunction Act. That's the first thing that's going to be argued before the court. Both the federal government and the states and the National Federation of Independent Business, so as all the parties to the litigation, have said, we think that the court should take this up. We don't buy the question of jurisdiction or standing or whatever with respect to taking it up. The issue, however, was enjoined in one of the lower courts in a different case, and the Supreme Court said, we want to hear from more about this, and so they engaged an outside counsel to write an amicus brief specifically on this, and this is going to be argued. I'm not going to get into great detail about this except for your questions, but I will tell you that I am firmly convinced, above all else, that the court will proceed to render a decision ultimately on the merits of this case and not kick the can down the road. But the kicking the can is all it would be if they were to rule that way. It wouldn't resolve anything, because the umbrella question here is if, in fact, this is considered to be a tax that we're dealing with on the individual mandate, you would have a two-year period roughly before this would get right, because when the law goes into effect in 2014, somebody has to pay the penalty, then they have to get the refund, and I don't want to get in the weeds on the arguments. I just want you to be aware, we're aware of that. If you want a question about it or don't understand it, I think all three of us are probably prepared to discuss it today, but I don't think that goes to the merit. Now let me conclude so you can go to your questions by making a couple of very quick points. On the individual mandate, there is always the issue that Simon raised about the importance of resolving these matters, and somehow it's become legend that by requiring people to buy insurance like this, it's the only way we can solve the problem of covering the uninsured. And unfortunately, I would respectfully disagree. There are a lot of other options. For one thing, Congress could have enacted an increase in the income tax. They could have attached it in some other way to some other taxing mechanism to pay for this. You don't have to have the individual mandate, which parries a very valuable interest under the Constitution with respect to what's the scope of the Commerce Clause? Just how broad can that power be? Is it limitless? Is any and all economic activity to be regulated by the federal government under the Commerce Clause? I think not. And even though that was an original thought back in the 1930s and 40s in some of those cases, the Supreme Court in recent decisions made it pretty clear they don't think that either. So that had become the crux issue here. And I think framing it a little bit for you to look at it that way, that's the heart of that debate. It's actually a fairly simple debate. The individual mandate is not as complicated a debate or an argument before the court, although a very important argument, not as complicated a one as the Medicaid argument, which is a little bit more complicated, and not as obtuse or difficult or foreign to understand as, say, the anti-injunction argument, or maybe even the severability argument. Our position, of course, is that in the states, is that you cannot tell somebody to go out and engage in activity in commerce. You can't. You can regulate it. The requirement of the Commerce Clause in the Constitution, or the provision giving power to Congress or to the federal government. If you remember, all power is not given to Congress or the federal government, or reserved to the states. The power is to regulate commerce. In this case, there is a requirement that somebody engage in commerce, and that's the distinction. On the Medicaid question, the issue is much more complicated in the sense that the states voluntarily engaged back in 1965 in a compact with the federal government as a partner in Medicaid. And there are those who will argue, and I'm sure that that's the precedent that Simon's referring to, that, and the federal government certainly argues this, the Justice Department, that you can voluntarily withdraw from Medicaid as a state, and therefore, at any time you want to, there's nothing here to worry about. If you don't like the requirements being imposed on you, then just withdraw completely. But I don't think anybody seriously believes any state would ever do that. Certainly Congress didn't. And that is, if you're following that argument, when you get to that point and you're covering this story, you're going to need to look at that a bit, because that's the basic problem here. There are hidden things in here. For example, the states are presently required by their agreement to contribute about 40%, maybe up to 50% of the cost of Medicaid coverage for any eligible person. And the eligible persons have grown over the years. It was originally a fairly small pool. It's grown. And then there's some flexibility for the states with regard to the level of coverage. And there's a lot of going back and forth. States help work to balance their budgets, with as big a single item often in their budgets being Medicaid, by making those adjustments. With the new law, with the Affordable Care Act, the states no longer have that flexibility. There are newly eligible people up to 133% of poverty level, never before covered. For a while, the federal government will pick up the tab for those new eligible people. But when you combine the individual mandate provision requiring people to have coverage with the fact that there are a lot of people who are not presently taking advantage of their existing eligibility for Medicaid, never applied for it, and then they're now going to have coverage somewhere, the belief by all the studies I've seen is that millions more will come forward at a huge cost to the states and ask for Medicaid coverage who already are eligible, and those the federal government does not pick up the additional tab for. In addition, there's a sneaky provision in the Medicaid section of the law that says that for the first time, the states are going to be required by the federal government to guarantee a sufficient number of doctors, hospital beds, nursing home beds, and other providers to take care of all the eligible Medicaid recipients. That can lead to a lot of litigations, a lot of additional cost. It's billions more. It's an enormously expensive program. And so the real issue here for the federal government and for the Supreme Court is how far can the federal government go in its spending provisions before it violates the 10th Amendment by commandeering the state's assets. And there is indication in dicta that, in fact, they can't go this far because Medicaid is the single largest grant program that ever existed. And the dicta says, hey, you know, at some point you are using the tools at hand to leverage the states in a way that's not acceptable to the 10th Amendment. So that's the shorthand of it. Thank you.
Ed, thanks very much. And thank you all for coming. If you were not here, we wouldn't be here. And so we appreciate your interest in the issue. Let me touch on a couple of things about this. First of all, let me say about the individual mandate or the minimum coverage provision. The court is really confronted with two totally conflicting narratives. And it's my own sense that the court's choice between those two narratives is going to be controlled at least as much by what's in the amici filings as in the merits briefs, because the merits briefs of the parties are more or less predictable. There's some refinements on what was argued below, but not a great many. But there is a great flow of amici. There are 81 amicus briefs on one side or the other of the of the issue. And I think what's said in those briefs from interested organizations is going to help shape the justice's choice between these two narratives. One of these is, and it's going to be very ably argued by Paul Clement, is that what the minimum coverage provision is all about is a threat to individual liberty, and that people are for the first time in history being coerced to enter a market that they choose not to enter. The competing narrative is the one that the argument that the government is arguing, and that is that this is nothing more nor less than a fairly conventional regulation of interstate commerce, and that is the Congress had decided to regulate the market not for health care, but for the financing of health care, that is health insurance. And if you want to examine the two sides of the government's argument, I suggest you go back and read two opinions that were issued in 2005 in the case called Gonzalez against Raich, which was the California medical marijuana case. Read Justice Scalia's concurring opinion, in which he talks about the really quite expansive authority of Congress to regulate even purely local activity if that is essential to the regulation of interstate commerce itself. By the way, I think the challengers, the plaintiffs here, have put too much emphasis on a supposed distinction between activity and inactivity. It is notable, I think, that distinction was not accepted by any lower court, even the 11th Circuit in striking down the mandate. It was also quite harshly ridiculed, I think, by Judge Sutton in the Sixth Circuit. So the activity-inactivity dichotomy, I don't think is going to carry a lot of weight with this court. But the other opinion you should read then, of course, is Justice Thomas's dissenting opinion in Raich, in which he says that the time has come for us to put a stop to this inevitable and complete and steady expansion of Congress's commerce power. And so I think we can already anticipate that on the mandate, Justice Thomas, and probably joined by Justice Alito, is going to go for the state's argument that this is a threat to individual liberty. But then I think the rest of the court is quite unpredictable. Let me also point out to you something that I think is procedurally significant, because I would certainly echo what both of my colleagues up here have said about the importance of the Medicaid issue, but I think I would like to spend a few minutes of time focusing your attention on the Anti-Injunction Act for two reasons. One, if this court finds in the end of its deliberations that it cannot compose a majority of five on one side or the other on the mandate issue, the discussion in the conference is then going to move towards, well, where can we find five votes? And I think at that point, also taking into account that what we are about to do is announce something in the midst of a presidential election campaign, the argument would move then towards the Anti-Injunction Act and the potential to kick this down the road. In this respect, I would recommend seriously that you read Judge Kavanaugh's opinion in the Seven Sky decision in the District of Columbia, because Judge Kavanaugh makes as good an argument as you can as to why the court should not be resolving the constitutional issue. But the AIA issue is a convenient method by which the court can, in fact, evade a ruling on the constitutional merits of the mandate. And I would certainly suggest to you that you spend a little time trying to understand the AIA issue and help your readers to understand it. Because remember, at least from the government's point of view, from the federal government's point of view, and from Robert Long's point of view, the court-appointed amicus, this is a jurisdictional statute. And if the court agrees that it's jurisdictional, then it has to ask and answer the question, is the mandate with its attached penalty a form of taxation? Because the Anti-Injunction Act could not be clearer Let me read it to you. No suit for the purpose of restraining the assessment or collection of any tax shall be maintained in any court by any person. And this is a court, by the way, that for several years now has been messing around with the distinction between jurisdictional and non-jurisdictional questions. A jurisdictional question goes to the basic authority of the court to decide. A non-jurisdictional question does not. If the court accepts Bob Long's argument that this is jurisdictional and that this is a tax provision, then there is not only a plausible, there is a highly credible argument that this lawsuit should not have gone forward on the Anti-Injunction Act. Let me point out to you a procedural wrinkle here that may make a difference. The court's normal habit is to hold their private conference on Wednesday afternoon on the cases that they've heard on Monday. They then hold their private conference to discuss the cases decided or argued on Tuesday and Wednesday on a Friday. So if they follow that normal pattern in this month, on Wednesday afternoon they will be discussing only the Anti-Injunction Act issue at the conference that afternoon. And at that point, and by the way, I think if you're able to go to the argument or certainly able to read the transcripts, I think you're going to be able to discern in the 90 minutes of argument on Monday on the Anti-Injunction Act whether or not that is a viable issue for the court. Because I think the justices will tip their hands on it. I do not think it is a slam dunk issue for the government, which wants to have a jurisdictional statute but make an exception in this case, nor do I think it's a slam dunk argument for the states that want it to be non-jurisdictional completely. Let me also say that I think you need to keep in mind that Justice Kennedy is very likely going to see this case in all of its dimensions as a test of the court's present attitude about the concept of federalism. There's no member of this court, not one, who is as passionate about the notion that the states retain their sovereignty and their dignity as sovereign entities. And Justice Kennedy, as a matter of fact, he wrote an opinion last year in a very interesting criminal case in which he made an argument that I don't think has ever been made before in the history of jurisprudence in this country, and that is that the federalism concept is really there to protect individual liberty rather than to protect the sovereignty and dignity of the states. It's an argument that's kind of a species of what James Madison talked about in the protection of individual liberty when you divide power vertically and horizontally. But Kennedy is very passionate about it. And so if Justice Kennedy perceives this to be a threat either to the sovereign dignity of the states, as Bill has argued that it clearly is, or he sees this as a threat to individual liberty, then I think Kennedy probably will go along with the notion that this is an extravagant use of Congress's power. Let me also say that one other thing, this, for those of you reporters who will be following this in March later, we don't yet know whether the court is going to release the audio tapes within an hour after the oral argument has completed, or whether they will follow their current practice, which is to release all of the audio tapes on Friday. The court is under an enormous amount of pressure to do something other than the current practice. And we have been told that there will be a statement from the court before March 26th in which they will tell us whether or not they're going to release the audio tapes on a same-day basis. If the court does not release the audio tapes on a same-day basis, then they will be released in the afternoon of Friday, the 31st. I can tell you, I think with complete assurance, there will be no live coverage, either audio or visual. John Roberts and a majority of the court is not yet willing to relax, however important the case may seem to be to those in the public or even to the justices themselves. So the only open issue about assisting you in coverage, particularly in audio coverage, is whether the tapes will be released that the afternoon of each one of the arguments. It does appear to me that very likely that the court will relax its present policy, and you'll be able to get the audio tapes. You also will be able to get the written transcripts on the court's own website within about an hour, no more than 90 minutes after the argument is over. And that, I know, is important to many of you who will not have a chance to get into the courtroom. And the transcripts now are very helpful because they identify the justices who ask the questions. There was a time for many years when the transcripts simply said, question, and then you didn't know who asked the question unless you were there. That's enough for me for now.
All right. Thank you very much. I noticed a lot of people taking detailed notes during Lyle's conversation.
Can I make one technical point?
Sure, Simon.
One hyper-technical tweak to Lyle's typically able presentation. On the Tax Anti-Injunction Act, just to make it even more abstruse and unintelligible than it already is, the concept of tax in the Anti-Injunction Act has been interpreted to be broader than the concept of tax as a constitutional matter. Hence, the court could decide that the Anti-Injunction Act applies and precludes a ruling on the mandate issue without actually deciding that the mandate constitutes a tax in the constitutional sense. And also, I guess another point is that even if the court invokes the Anti-Injunction Act to avoid a ruling on the mandate issue, that would not apply to the Medicaid expansion issue. So it will still have to face that issue.
And if I could add to that, too, is while we're on this, there's still one other subtlety here. The states are arguing, and I think very ably, the one question Lyle raised about jurisdiction, which goes to the heart in the first place, is this a claims processing matter or is this a jurisdictional matter? But they're also arguing, which I think is the correct argument, was not particularly noticed in the lower courts because Judge Vinson just went on and did his thing, and so the 11th Circuit, that, you know, the states have standing to be here regardless of the individuals at this point. And the Anti-Injunction Act only applies to individuals, doesn't apply to states. So, and the states have an interest in the individual mandate because it directly affects them through the Medicaid provisions in what I described earlier with respect to the fact that now that we have an individual mandate, everybody's got to have insurance, then more people, according to all the studies by everybody, no question about this, more people who are currently eligible for Medicaid are going to go out and sign up that wouldn't otherwise, and therefore it's going to run up their bill. So there is a direct impact on the states of the individual mandate and an opportunity to be heard on the merits on the individual mandate for the states does not occur or is not triggered by the provisions in 2014. It's real right now. And in addition to that, there is no alternative remedy. There is an exception, as there are to every rule, to the Anti-Injunction Act where there's no real remedy or relief otherwise. So there's a tremendous hidden argument in here. I told you I wouldn't get into the weeds unless you wanted me to, but these two fellows have raised interesting points about it, and it's if you're really going to look at that, then I suggest you go look at the brief, for example, that the states filed on anti-injunction. You can find the briefs, by the way, I'm sure, on the Supreme Court website, but you can also go to several of these state attorney general websites. The easiest one to find it, I hate to acknowledge another than Florida, but South Dakota Attorney General website, healthcare lawsuit, every one of the briefs is just right there, boom, 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 boom. Just punch the button and you can see them.
Let me engage in a little free advertising for my blog, too. The SCOTUS blog, which I hope some of you use, has every one of the briefs also, including all of the 135 amici briefs, easily linked. And, by the way, our blog is totally free, so there's no cost. The American Bar Association also has all of the briefs online. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court does not. The Supreme Court website has the petitions for cert. It does not have any one of the merits or the amici briefs that have been filed. So the court made a small gesture by putting the petitions and the responses online, but that's as far as they've gone in terms of making access to the papers. There's also another website also free. Brad Junduff, who is a law professor at Santa Clara University, has a blog called ACA Litigation Blog, and Brad has been very diligent in following this all the way through, and he, too, has posted the briefs for your access.
So if you read 20 briefs a day between now and the 26th, you should be able to...
That's more reading than the 2,700 pages of the bill.
All right. We have the opportunity for you to ask questions. We would ask that you, A, wait until the handheld microphone that will be brought to you is brought to you, and B, identify yourself as you ask the question. Yes.
Hi, Scott Hensley from Shots, NPR's health blog. Which of the briefs do you recommend we read first? And I start with Lyle.
Well, obviously, I think because the court itself, the justices themselves will have read the merits briefs of the parties and the amici, the appointed amici. I doubt that there are very many of the members of the court who will read very many of the amici filings. They will get those summarized for them by their own clerks or by the clerk's pool. So you definitely have to read the parties' briefs, and I would start with those. But by the way, the court has appointed Washington attorneys to argue the Anti-Injunction Act issue from the perspective of claiming that no one would have standing to bring this because the statute's jurisdiction. And Robert Long of Covington and Burling has done a really solid brief on the merits on that issue. If you're interested in that issue, I would also recommend that you read one amicus brief is filed on behalf of Mort Kaplan and Sheldon Cohen, who are two former Internal Revenue Commissioners, and that's also a very solid brief on the merits. On the severability issue, Bartow Farr, the Washington law firm, has filed the amicus brief on the severability issue. It's a very, very solid piece of work. So there's a lot of reading there, but if I were you, I would read very selectively among the amici. But there are 81 briefs on the amici side on the severability issue, so they're going to be more of a challenge to you than on any of the other three issues.
And by the way, each of the parties' briefs are directed to a different subject matter. So, for example, you can read a separate brief by the states on anti-injunction or by the government or whatever, and the same is true with individual mandate, severability, and Medicaid. They're all separate briefs, so you don't have to read them all one time.
And they're labeled on the face of the brief.
So. Right.
I would suggest that among the amici brief, off the top of my head, I would strongly suggest if you're interested in the Medicaid issue, Bill has ably summarized his own side's brief here. There's a brief filed by several states that are governed by Democrats, of all things, California, Oregon, Washington, Connecticut, I think, I can't remember what else. It's an extremely good brief, and it explains why the Medicaid expansion is beneficial to the states. It takes, I think, quite compelling issue with a number of the assertions that Bill made here. But in any event, it presents the other side of the story very well and makes clear that this is really a Democrat versus Republican issue and not really a state versus federal power issue. The other brief I would suggest is a brief that I was involved in writing that explains why the individual mandate is necessary to assure access to affordable insurance coverage for people who have pre-existing conditions, which is really the strongest basis for the constitutionality of the law, I think. And the Justice Department has consistently cited that brief at all phases in its oral arguments and in its own briefs, including its briefs to the Supreme Court, which is, I like to think, its way of signaling to the justices that if you read anything, you should read this.
Which brief is that, Simon?
It's on behalf of the Association of American Association of People with Disabilities, I think, and about 10 to 20, 17, something like that, other patient advocacy and so-called disease groups.
Very good. I think we have a question here, and then on my right.
Hi, I'm Penny Starr with CNS News. Can one of you address the issue about all or nothing? In other words, if the court is ruling on one particular part of the law, how that's going to affect the rest of the law, say that they strike down the individual mandate but keep the other part?
Well, I can try that. And these are two very able colleagues on this subject. It's a very objective question. It's the issue of severability is dependent upon an interpretation of what the Congress intended. Would they have passed the law in all of its parts, or would some of its parts not have passed if the individual mandate were not there? It is, as Simon said, in this particular variation, the funding mechanism that allows the pre-existing coverage to be there, or otherwise insurance companies couldn't afford to offer it. It's true for a number of other insurance provisions in the bill that clearly, in my opinion, wouldn't stand scrutiny in Congress if they didn't have a funding mechanism. Now, there are other ways they could skin the cat, as I've said, but in this bill, they chose the individual mandate. So in my way of thinking, and it's, again, just my way of thinking, and not the way we're arguing in the court, this is just me personally, I think the court would, if it strikes the individual mandate, would have a very hard time not at least determining that the insurance provisions are also going to have to go. But that's a question. They could determine that. They could pick them out. They could send it back down to the district court and say, you pick it out, which Judge Vinson said, like Brer Rabbit, I don't want to be thrown in the briar patch. That Congress ought to decide this. They could, of course, decide what Judge Vinson did, and that is that all of this is so intertwined, which when you take a look at Medicaid and you look at what I described as the state's problems that arise because of the individual mandate, when it was all tied together, they could say, wow, there's so much of this. You know, maybe there's a little piece over here we could pick out, but would Congress have really passed this whole bill if all of this, you know, if we were going to find this unconstitutional, they couldn't do it this way, and we ought to send it back and let Congress figure out a different way to do it, because there are other ways to do it. That's my clearest way of saying it. But procedurally, they have the choice of striking it all, say it's gone, it's all gone, or they could decide some of it is gone in addition to an individual mandate, or they could send that question down to the district court to decide some of it's gone. Or, of course, they could decide everything's constitutional.
It might be helpful if you think of this in terms of a hierarchy of decisions that the court has to make. Because there is an argument under the AIA that this is a jurisdictional matter, the court has to confront that issue first. And let's assume for the sake of the argument that it concludes that it is not jurisdictional, or if it is jurisdictional, it doesn't apply to this particular act. The court then moves to the question of the constitutionality of the mandate itself. And if the court rules that the mandate was within Congress's power, either under the Commerce Clause, under the Necessary and Proper Clause, or under the General Welfare Taxing Clause, then it doesn't have to confront the question of severability. So then step three is, let's assume that they've struck down a severability question under one of those three heads of legislative authority. Then they have to, as Bill says, they have to confront the question of would Congress have wanted any or some parts of the remainder of the statute? And two, a very difficult second question, can the statute operate in the way that Congress would have wanted it to if Congress knew that it couldn't have the mandate? And I think the government has made, I think, too narrow an argument about severability. The government says that only two provisions really would have to fall if the mandate does. One is the universal coverage concept. Two, that is the question the insurance companies cannot raise their premiums beyond what prevails in their region. I think if the mandate falls, I think the Medicaid part of the statute also has to fall. I don't think that the entire statute has to fall. For example, though this is very debatable, The insurance industry has already adapted to the coverage of dependents up to the age of 26. Now, the insurance industry will tell you that economically they can't afford to do that unless they have a guaranteed pool of premium contributors. So, but I think Bill is probably right in his speculation that one of the options is that if the court strikes down the mandate, they very likely will send it back to the 11th Circuit and say, you deal with this first. And then the question about Medicaid, I think Medicaid conceivably could be decided on its own, but I think, as Bill says, I think it is too closely intertwined with the whole universal coverage concept. And the whole universal coverage concept is so intertwined with the mandate that probably has to go too. But that's the hierarchy in which the court will be confronting the issues.
I'm going to have to just disagree briefly with my colleague here. I think that the severability issue with respect to the mandate, I actually think that it's relatively simple, and I could be wrong, but I think the question is, what would Congress have intended, as Bill said? That's what the legal issue is. Regardless of what any kind of argument you can make about what objectively the connection between the mandate and other provisions of the bill is, the question is, would Congress have enacted these other provisions if it knew that the mandate was going to fall? And the fact is that the argument that the government is making, namely that two of the insurance reforms are the only provisions that should fall if the mandate falls, namely the provision that protects access for people with pre-existing conditions and the community rating provision, which forbids insurers to take account of people's individual health status when determining what their premiums are going to be. And there's a clear objective connection. But more importantly, in assessing the subjective intent of Congress, Congress spelled out in its findings, which, by the way, I commend to you if you want to understand why the mandate is in the statute. Its findings in the statute that the mandate was essential for those two provisions, and those two provisions alone. So the fact that it named those two provisions and did not name any other provisions, I think, should be pretty definitive in terms of what it would have done had it known it couldn't get the mandate upheld. So I think it's very likely. It's very unlikely, it seems to me, that the court will go beyond that. But I could be wrong.
There's an article in the current issue of the New England Journal that raises the question of what happens if the mandate is struck down and the two provisions the government suggests go with it are struck down, to the calculation of the subsidies that go into the exchanges, which are in some ways keyed to the rates that result from community rating and the individual mandate.
You know, I'd also like to just point one other thing about the Medicaid. The point that Lyle makes, that the Medicaid provisions are so inextricably tied to the mandate that they would have to go to. The argument on that side, which Bill and his colleagues have made very ably, is that the mandate can't really be implemented if the states don't add a lot of people and the federal government to their Medicaid rolls. The problem with that argument is that people who are poor enough to be eligible for Medicaid, even under the expanded eligibility that the ACA provides for, those people are, with almost no exceptions, I think, exempt from the penalties for not complying with the mandate. Therefore, the argument that the whole scheme of the mandate depends on forcing people to go running to sign up for Medicaid, I think is very flawed, and would be particularly flawed with respect to the severability issue.
By the way, even if they don't pay any penalties, they still are under the requirement to sign up for insurance. And the studies, not ours, but every independent study says that they will, at least a very high percentage.
I don't disagree with that.
Well, let me jump back in on this. When Simon appropriately points you to the findings, I think the most definitive finding that Congress made was that we have to reform the insurance market. We have to push the industry away from the traditional reliance upon risk avoidance. We have to have universal or nearly universal coverage, and economically you cannot have near universal coverage if you take away the avoidance of risk factor and don't supply us with a pool of premium contributors. And Congress would not have passed the Affordable Care Act in any dimension without first having committed itself to the idea that instead of going for a public option, instead of going for a Treasury finance program, it wanted to go through the mechanism of reforming the industry that provides health insurance. And that is an industry that simply actuarially cannot function with a risk avoidance opportunity taken away from it unless it is guaranteed an adequate pool of payers of premiums. And you can talk to any health industry person you want on either side of the equation, and they will tell you that if we do not have an adequate pool of people who have to have insurance, we cannot expand our coverage unless you allow us to jack up our premiums to the point that nobody in the country, perhaps not even Mitt Romney, could afford.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
With Hearst Newspapers. Just to change the subject a little, I'm interested in Congressman McCollum can start with this. What's the posture of the states at this juncture, especially the 26 states, that are in the resistance mode, Florida, Texas. This is a time when the law is requiring the states to implement various provisions of the ACA, and there's a lot of talk about the whole question of exchanges, setting up exchanges. What are states, particularly, as I say, the 26, to do at this time, and is there any promise of closure with the decision in June?
Well, most of the 26 states, maybe all of them, have opted not to pass exchange laws. And as you know, if there is no state exchange, there isn't a provision for the federal government to go in and provide the exchange. The states are under extraordinary pressure in this regard for a lot of reasons. The cost is not necessarily in creating the exchange, but it is in complying with all of the insurance provisions that we haven't even talked about some of them today, because the federal government for the first time in the ACA began, says the point of this is to regulate insurance, health insurance, for what Lyle described, that I think for that reason. But in the process of doing so, you may recall, some of you may not even know this, that every state has currently, for a basic insurance policy, health insurance policy, mandates of coverage. And there might be, like in Florida, close to 60. It's very debatable, by the way, that there should be 60 different things that are covered in everybody's insurance policy, which is one of the reasons the insurance policies cost so much, which is a huge problem, but it's a political problem, because all these interest groups want their thing covered, and your insurance carriers, like Blue Cross, want to keep all the, all of these things up. And so while many studies have recommended reducing the number of these coverages down to 10 or 12, that's not happened. It's not likely to happen. And in the law, in the ACA, there's a little noticed provision that says, hey, we're going to come forward, and federal government, and we're going to tell you what's going to be in a basic policy that has to be from the federal end of it. And that's where the whole contraception debate comes from that you've been seeing politically lately. Forget the politics of that or anything else about it. That's the premise of that regulatory decree that's under that power. But here's the kicker. If a state has, let's say the federal government comes out with 15 or 20 requirements for coverage, and the states have 60, and let's assume for the sake of argument that the 15 or 20, let's say it's 20, are all exactly like 20 of the ones the states had. For the additional 40, unless the states repeal them, which they're not going to do, they've got to pay into the federal government. and they've got to pay a lot of money, and it's a huge amount of money. And I've looked at my state insurance commissioner's report on this to the state legislature, and it's a hidden amount. I mean, that's why this is so complicated and intertwined. The cost to the states of the Medicaid provisions and the insurance provisions all combined, that's why they're so intertwined, Simon. It's just staggering, and that's why we think as states that our argument is going to get a lot of attention, like Lyle said, with Justice Kennedy and others, because it is there's nothing. I mean, we can talk about the safety net going forward, but there's never been anything this big that the federal government has required as an addendum or an attachment to a grant program, especially one that's been in place since 1965, to which the states were not given an opt-out after they signed up. There's no way they can really opt out. They can't opt out of the new stuff without losing all of the Medicaid. They've got to go out of all of it. They can't say, hey, okay, we'll stay with the old stuff, and we won't take the new. They've got to take it all, or they have to get out of all of it. This is a practical matter. They're not going to get out of any of this. And they're going to. It's going to cost schools. It's going to cost other programs. And it's very real. I mean, it's not just an argument for the Supreme Court. It's a very you asked me a pragmatic question, I think, of what are the states going to do? And that's why they're having trouble with exchanges and everything else right now.
I just, as an answer to the another extremely able and eloquent presentation by Bill, if you're interested in this Medicaid issue, you ought to take a look at a completely overlooked speech on the Senate floor on December 15th as Congress was rushing to its recess last December by one Charles Grassley, a well-known friend of the ACA and the White House, in which to his great credit, he challenged every single argument that Bill has summarized out of his Republican state official colleagues' legal attack on Medicaid expansion, precisely because he understood that their argument means not just the end of the Medicaid expansion in this bill, but the end of Medicaid from the beginning to end, as well as, I think he stated, every other program in which Congress prescribes conditions that put 100% of the funding of the program at risk if a state doesn't want to comply with them, which is staggering in the sweep of that, and what a revolution or a counter-revolution it would mean. So I would recommend you going to the record on December 15th and also the brief of Democratic states I mentioned, and also there are briefs on both of these issues by several hundred progressive state legislators filed by the Constitutional Accountability Center that also have very powerful arguments about why the mandate and the Medicaid expansion are actually beneficial to states.
If Senator Grassley were here, he and I have debated lots of times, I would make the point, Simon, that it isn't what we intend to say you can't ever do this, because obviously lots of things the states will do, the federal government will do to the states in regard to requirements. It's the totality of this, the enormity of it. This is bigger than anything conceivable ever done with respect to commandeering the states, with respect to anything, period. So the question before the court is there a point beyond which you can't go? Not a question of can you do these things that have been done in the past, because they've already said they're okay. The question is this one step too far? And if so, what's the limiting line? What's the limiting provision? And we're asking the federal government, we're asking the Supreme Court, to draw a line, a definition of what is a limitation on the spending power add-ons that you can have requirements on the states.
Let me, can I add a little bit of a complicating factor on this? Bill has referred several times to the concern that in the ACA, Congress is undertaking to commandeer the states. Actually, that's not the argument that Bill's own lawsuit makes. He makes a coercion argument, and that's different from a commandeering argument. When the court was going through its federalism revolution in the 1970s, led by Rehnquist, O'Connor, and Kennedy, the court regularly reinforced the sovereignty of the states by finding that Congress had commandeered the structures or the officials of the state into a federal activity. The court, in two cases, one in 1967 and another in 1987, laid down the theory. Now, so far it's only a theory, that in the use of Congress's authority under the spending clause, it can impose such onerous conditions on a state that a state simply has no option but to bow to Congress's will in order to be able to receive the money. The coercion argument has never, never once been applied in a case by the Supreme Court to strike down a piece of spending clause legislation. But the states have raised this issue repeatedly. I can tell you that in my last 15 years of covering the court, I have seen at least two petitions for cert every term by one or more states trying to invoke the coercion argument. And the inability up to this point of the states to make that argument was the reason why everybody was surprised when the court accepted the Medicaid mandate question for review. Because every lower court judge who looked at this said, the court may have mentioned this twice, but the court has never applied it, and we don't think there's anything left of the coercion argument. But in the face of that history, in the face of the Federalism Revolution, in the face of the court repeatedly having bypassed this issue, the court granted that issue. And it appointed a very competent lawyer to argue that issue. And I must tell you that there are many people in the social welfare community who believe that that is really the most important issue in this case, because aside from Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, if the coercion argument is found to prevail in this argument, you can kiss goodbye to the idea that there is a social safety net that the federal government can impose or inaugurate. So that is a really big issue, but it is a coercion issue and not a commandeering issue.
With due respect, one comment. I know, Ed, you want to go on to Lyle. This is a coercion issue to the extent that if coercion is so great, it becomes commandeering. That's what our brief says. That's what our argument is. And it is to that point. This is so great that the line needs to be drawn to say you can't go quite that far.
Okay, we have only about 10 minutes to squeeze in some questions, and we have some folks who have lined up. And would I ask them to be as brief as they can and ask our panelists as brief as they can in their responses?
Hi, Anthony Wilson from American Healthline. It's been suggested mostly by liberals, but that the Bush versus Gore case in 2000 has colored the court as partisan, ideologically driven. Can you comment on that and maybe talk about how perhaps that's the only reason, in liberal eyes at least, that this case is even moving forward?
Well, let me comment to this extent. I know Simon earlier said that this was really a Democrat-Republican argument or whatever. Actually, the state's position was never intended, nor is it truly a Democrat-Republican argument for the attorneys general. I'm not going to disclose their names, but I will tell you with all honesty, and many of you know me very well, there were three or four Democrat attorneys generals when I first started this case who wanted to join it, but who felt the political pressure, worried about their reelection, worried about it because health care and ACA had become such a politicized issue in Congress that it was a Democrat-Republican thing in that world. But attorneys general historically have been about protecting the state's interest from the encroachments of the federal government. And it's very fundamental, whether it's federalism or whatever the role is, the federal government comes in our turf, we go about defending it. So if you really want to look at this from the standpoint of the states, which is the way I looked at it, it should not be viewed as a Democrat or Republican argument. Now, whether the individual justices who have been appointed by different presidents have different political perspectives, I don't know that I want to go that far. I would suggest they have their own independent viewpoint, molded and shaped by their own history. This is why a student like Lyle of each justice and Paul Clement and Simon and others who study these justices can somewhat predict what they might do in certain given circumstances. But I don't think you can say that it's politicized the Supreme Court in that sense. But for the public, with all the media where it is today, and because this is a politicized issue in the very nature of it, the ACA, then, of course, it's subject to that interpretation. I don't believe that it actually is.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Next.
Hello. My name is Adrian. I'm with the Talking About Men's Health blog. And this question is specifically for Mr. McCollum. You had mentioned there are a number of smaller hidden messages. Smaller hidden issues in the ACA that weren't going to be addressed by the court. And I was wondering if you thought that the Mikulski Amendment in the ACA, which created guidelines for women's preventive services, but none for for the other half of the population, did you think that was one of the issues that were not going to be addressed, but that probably should?
Well, first of all, we're here to address the court issues today, constitutionality issues today. We examined those and filed this because of the state's interest and the individual mandate in Medicaid. I don't pretend to tell you there aren't other things that could be challenged in this, or to tell you there aren't several hundred political issues embedded in it. And we could go on with a long list today, and I don't think addressing one issue you've raised like that, it doesn't fit this mold, with all due respect. And are there other issues in here? Yes, there are. But the time is limited. I could start rattling off five or six, but they're political. They're not part of the court case.
The court was very selective in granting review. Remember, in November, when the court took this up at its conference, its private conference, it had six cases before it that it could have granted. It had five, at least, and one was about to be filed later from the D.C. Circuit. And the court went through those five cases and very selectively picked out what it wanted to decide. And all of them go, and they're all raised either in the Florida case or by the appointment of an amicus to bring them up. So one issue the court did not take, which the states wanted them to take, and I think they should have taken, was whether or not the employer mandate is also unconstitutional under the Commerce Clause, but the court did not take that. So I think the court's intent here was to do a very focused inquiry into the most important basic constitutional questions and leave everything else to either later legislative process or later litigation.
We have time for one more question. Jill?
Jill Wexler with Managed Healthcare Executive Magazine. I'm wondering how much observers are going to be able to take out from the arguments coming up, whether there are issues and questions that you are looking for them to raise that would be signals for how they might decide this, or also if there are issues that they don't raise that might be a signal for how they're looking at these, at their decisions.
Well, this is a very fast court, as those of us who hang around there call it. You can pretty well tell where the justices are going to go on issues that are really very clear-cut. But once you start moving into the issues at the margin, where the issues of subtlety and nuance, then you can't tell where the court's going. But when the court is confronted with issues as starkly opposed as they are in this case, I think the justices, you're going to be able to read them very closely. But what I would suggest to you is, during the argument on the Anti-Injunction Act, pay very close attention to where Justice Kennedy is. Because Kennedy, by the way, has not participated as actively in the last couple of years as he did in his middle years, because there are too many other justices asking too many questions. But Kennedy does tend to ask questions that very strongly telegraph where he is when the issue is very clear-cut. During the argument on the individual mandate, I would suggest that you pay very close attention to what Justice Scalia asks, because of where Scalia was in the Raich case on medical marijuana. I don't think you need to pay much attention to what Justice Alito says. And for most of the progressives, I think on the mandate, you can assume that they're going to go with the government. Steve Breyer has almost never found a government policy that he didn't think was valid. So you can count him as with the government. But I also would suggest that you pay really close attention to what Roberts says on the individual mandate, because I don't think John Roberts wants to be the fifth one, if there are only five votes, to strike down the mandate. But if there is, and I think Adam Liptak pointed this out pretty clearly in a story that he had last week, if there are six votes, and the sixth vote to strike down the mandate is from John Roberts, John Roberts will go along with that rather than have the court do it by a five-vote majority. I don't think John wants to have a decision that close. But I think by the end of the day on Monday, you will be able to get a good sense of where they are on the AIA, and certainly at the end of 2 hours. But what I would watch for is this two narratives question. Watch how the court reacts to what John or Paul Clement says on the individual mandate, because if the court is with him, it will be pretty clear fairly on, and particularly from Scalia and Roberts. And so you can read a lot in the oral argument. You cannot bet the farm on it, but if you read them very closely and try to hear the nuances, then there are nuances even when there are black and white issues. But you can hear from the justices where they are, because all of them understand that the purpose of oral argument is not to let counsel make an argument to them. It's to persuade each other and to set the agenda for the conference discussion that's going to follow. So they are really trying to shape the thrust of where the conversation is going to go once they get back behind the curtains.
I think Lyle's given you an excellent analysis of that. I just want to add this cautionary word that he put in there at one point. When we went to the 11th Circuit and I got to sit on that one, I'm not eligible to sit on these despite bringing the lawsuit. I'm not an AG and I don't have a seat in there. But I sat at the 11th Circuit hearings, and the hearings were set for a very limited period of time, as they all are, oral arguments. And it was shocking almost to everybody that they ran for an hour and a half longer because the three judges of the 11th Circuit wanted to ask this enormous amount of questions about the Medicaid part of this. And it went on and on. And listening to the questions, you'd have to have concluded, wow, maybe we're really going to get an opinion favorable. And they gave very short shrift of it in their opinion. So, and the judge who asked the most questions was the one who was most absolutely against, you know, didn't think there was any merit to the Medicaid provisions. But he, from his questions, Lyle, you would have thought, golly, you know, he's really going there. He's arguing the state's case, as you said, you could hear in the Supreme Court. So it's just a red flag, as we say in the law. I think the justices are much more predictable because you do know them better. And if you listen to what Lyle suggested, you probably will get clues. But it's a real warning flag that they can be very misleading sometimes.
And by the way, the arguments will not run much longer than the allotted time. John Roberts is not Bill Rehnquist. And we always used to say metaphorically that Bill Rehnquist had a lever with a trapdoor underneath the counsel, and if the red light went on, the trapdoor opened and the counsel disappeared somewhere in the bowels of the court. But John Roberts will allow a little bit of leeway. If it looks like there are justices who have more questions, if he kind of gets the sense that we haven't quite got to the end of this, John will let it run on for maybe 10 or 15 minutes longer. But with 6 hours allotted to it, I don't think you could expect it's going to be a lot of extra time.
And let's see, 5-6 minutes of extra time, according to our schedule. I have no lever to pull either here or there. But I do have kudos to hand out to our panelists. I want to thank the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for its sponsorship, co-sponsorship of this briefing. Thank you for being so willing to offer good opportunities for analysis from our panelists. And I don't know if reporters do this as a matter of course, but if you'd like to join me in thanking the panel for a great conversation, now is the time. And 90 minutes after this meeting adjourns, we will not have the transcript for you posted on our website, but check us in 3 or 4 days.